Morning, everyone. Good morning. Jack Tamin, the chair on Newstalk ZBE, through to midday today. And hey, if you are looking for love in all the wrong places, but you still want to find the one, keep listening. My guest this morning is married at first sight love expert Dr. Tricia Stratford. She's part of a team of three, and as a clinical neuropsychotherapist, matches couples to be married, having never met them before. Tricia has had a fascinating life, to say the least. She's a former journo, war correspondent, hostage negotiator, and she is with us this morning from Australia. Kia ora, good morning.
Kia ora.
Hey, thank you for being with us. We of course, have many, many questions about Married at First Sight this morning and about matchmaking, but I thought perhaps it might be interesting to start a wee way back, a few decades ago in your career, because you have lived a fascinating life, to say the least. So take us back to first of all, when you were a journalist. How did you get into journalism?
I started at Radio Windy in Wellington. That's a blast from the past.
There you go. And where did that lead you?
Well, it led me eventually to television.
Yeah.
And then I did the usual newsroom, and then I ended up in 60 Minutes. And then I left to make documentaries when New Zealand On Air was set up.
Wow.
So I was really interested in social documentaries. So I suppose the theme, and then of course ended up as a war correspondent. I think the theme that running through my life is that I'm really interested in people, observing people, finding out why, you know, all those things that we do as journalists.
Because that's very much a common theme with what you do now, isn't it?
Correct. And after I'd been in Somalia and Bosnia and Rwanda, I thought, you know, we can do better than this. We can be nicer to people.
Yeah.
So I went and did my conflict resolution and mediation training in the States.
Right.
Did a bit of work with that. And then I ended up then really getting interested in the brain. So, because I thought that might have a lot to do with it as well.
Yeah.
So I went back and studied neuroscience and did my PhD and my postdoc research. I'm interested in human potential more than anything and how we can do it better.
Tell you what, Tricia, your pool room must have a lot of features. That is an amazing career. You know, I think you said you were in Bosnia and Somalia and Rwanda. Was that for reporting, or were you working for the UN? Because obviously we hear, Bosnia and Rwanda, Somalia, we think of war crimes and various genocides and things in the 90s.
Yes. I was there in Somalia for 18 months. I was the only journalist in Somalia. I lived in a container on the port. And I fired stories for 60 Minutes Australia, BBC, CNN.
This is in Mogadishu?
Yeah.
What year was that? Was that pre or post Black Hawk Down?
No, just as it was happening.
Wow.
And then I was the last one there as they all left.
Oh, because, I mean, that was a fascinating little period to be in Africa, I can imagine, because it was only a few months after Black Hawk Down that the Rwandan genocide kicked off.
Correct, yeah. I think it was an interesting time, but a very sad time.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Somalia really hasn't got any better. But I mean, I have got a funny story to tell you. I ended up back in Washington, D.C. for 6 months, which is when I actually wrote Blood Money, the book Blood Money.
Yeah.
And I suddenly got this call from the head of the CIA, who wanted to have lunch with me when they flew me up to New York. And it was the funniest thing because he arrived with four guys beside him with clearly guns because, you know, it's bulging out.
Yeah.
And the lunch was about, they believed that I knew, and I was in Mogadishu at the time, that Al-Qaeda formed.
Wow.
And that could I give them information. Yeah.
So Al-Qaeda had formed in Somalia.
Yeah, I think that's a story that's never really been told in terms of, we knew that there were rebels and rebel gangs, but I don't think they'd given themselves the name Al-Qaeda.
Was it Al-Shabaab back then?
No, it wasn't. Al-Shabaab's newer.
Right.
And Yeah, so down in the southern part of Somalia. Mm.
Gee, man, what an incredible thing to have experienced. I mean, I'm sure an awful thing to have experienced as well, because Clinton was in charge and then the Americans pulled out, and I mean, it was already in a pretty dire state, but Somalia just really went off the cliff then, and then you had Rwanda kicking off, just up the way, and then of course the Yugoslavia was falling apart as well at the same time. So did you go to Bosnia after Africa, or was that before Africa?
No, that was after, and I made a documentary in Bosnia, and travelled from one end of Bosnia to the other. I hired a cameraman from ex-military Sandhurst in the UK, and we got a World War II jeep and drove up and down Bosnia. And of course, the time around then and Srebrenica and everything, and there was nowhere to stay. Quite often we would sleep out. Really interesting. They're all interesting experiences.
Well, there were a handful of New Zealand journalists who were kicking around in those places throughout that period. Did you come across the New Zealanders, the likes of Cameron Bennett, Margaret Moth, and those types?
No, I didn't. I think, I was just around, and I suppose they were too, and we missed each other, and I was making a documentary and get all my tapes back then out to Spit and then go back in, and extra fuel because you couldn't buy fuel.
No, of course.
Food, you know, all that kind of thing. You're really busy just doing all that and doing your own thing.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that someone who has experienced that and experienced some of the various, very worst traits of our species in the last 30 years is now in a position where you're focusing on bringing people together. You know what I mean? Like you go from seeing the very worst of humanity to trying to see the very best in some respects.
Well, I think that's a survival thing. You know, I have to believe that we're better than that.
Yeah.
And television found me. I was very happily doing postdoc research at the time at university. I always had my practice. And I do training, on building resilience workshops and things like that. But I was doing it, and I got rung up by the production company over here, and they said, "Look, we're doing the show. You're interested?" And I said, "No, I don't do reality television." And I said that about three or four times. They kept ringing, and anyway, they just said, "Look, come on over and talk to us." So I said, "Well, look, I can come over today, but I'm coming straight from the lab, jeans, T-shirt, pretty scruffy."
Yeah.
And I arrived there, and long story short, they wanted me to do it. And I thought about it, and Channel 9 wanted me to do it, and I thought, well, it's an ideal opportunity to take these theories out of the lab and test them in reality.
Yeah.
I thought it was a wonderful opportunity.
Because I can understand your reservations. I mean, I can imagine you move in fairly intellectual circles, and having had an intellectual career and things, that when you get a call from a reality TV producer, that must be an interesting thing.
Lecturing in neuroscience one day. And but it's an opportunity, you know. It's an experiment.
Yeah.
And so we set the parameters up. And we observe and we test the theories about what is it that attracts us to other people? What is it that helps us to communicate? What is it that helps us be nice to other people? You know, we test all those theories, put them in a pressure situation, of course, and watch what happens.
Yeah. It is a fascinating concept. Maybe we can step back for a moment, and if you're allowed to, you could tell us a little bit about what is involved with the production. Because we're, I think, in season 5 of the Australian series in New Zealand at the moment. I know you've signed on for another series. But how does it work for the people who volunteer to go on a TV show and be married to a complete stranger? Do you have a lot of people who are prepared to go through that experience?
Yeah, this year we had 5,000.
Whoa! 5,000? Who are these people?
5,000.
Yeah.
Well, I think they are people who want a partner. They're lonely and they want a partner. And they've all tried certain things. Now, look, we do screen them. And then we come down to a certain number. And then that certain number goes through testing to make sure that, you know, they're psychologically able to withstand the show.
Yeah.
And then we test them, John, Mel and myself. So my testing, we put them together. It takes about 10 weeks. I'm working on all the profiles and I test them. And then when we get down to, and John comes up with his, you know, sort of list, and I come up with mine and Mel, and then we get to I test them in the lab, the sort of the top 50.
Right.
And so I do, I test the brain and the emotional brain. I test the neural pathways in the brain on how resilient they are, how optimistic they are, because we know if you're resilient and optimistic, you're more likely to stay in a relationship. I test their emotional intelligence, how good they are at reading their feelings and their partners. Social intelligence, how good they are at reading the group, and also their level of commitment. And then I get them in the lab and I do pheromone testing and I do attractiveness testing.
Right.
The pheromone testing, they get sent a T-shirt, every participant does.
Yeah.
A white T-shirt and a Ziploc bag, and they need to wear that to bed every night for 7 nights. And then, and no pungent food, or hopefully, you know, no drugs, no alcohol if they can, because that all comes out and you sweat.
Yeah.
Because I want the body odour. And then they come back in and I get them to smell it. So smell is our most pungent sense. It only goes through one synapse to the brain. Eyesight goes through 4. Hearing goes through 7. So, you know, it's our most immediate sense.
Yeah.
It evokes memories. But the most important thing is what a woman is doing. She can detect a man's body odour that she's attracted to at about a metre.
Wow.
And what she's doing is she's detecting his immune system, whether it's different to hers but compatible enough so you have healthy offspring.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's complicated.
Yeah.
I love the brain. It's
yeah, it is complicated. It is wonderful to hear you speaking about this stuff on intellectual terms, because, I mean, there is the temptation with reality TV to expect the producers just go in and go, you know what, we're going to put two diametrically opposed people together, we're going to force them to get married, and then we're going to film as it all falls apart.
Well, we sometimes do put people together. If someone's particularly anxious, we put them with someone who's very grounded.
Yeah.
Because they are a good match on other levels, but we're hoping the grounded partner will help the other one not to be so anxious. I think you see that with Sarah and Tel.
Yeah.
So there is a bit of that. But what we cannot, we cannot control for are the families.
Right.
The parents,
yeah,
the whole environment that they go into, and it's extraordinary what turns up every year.
Yeah, is there one couple that sticks out in your mind as having been particularly surprising?
Surprising this year in terms of staying together.
Well, staying together or immediately combusting, perhaps.
Yeah. Well. I was very surprised at the Dean, Davina, Tracy, because we thought Dean and Tracy were well matched. There was the issue that she had a daughter, but we'd never put someone with someone who has a child if they said they're not prepared to do that.
Right.
Like, the biggest deal breakers are height and smoking. Men do not want a woman taller than them.
Right.
And they don't want anyone who smokes. And sometimes having children is a deal breaker. So we're very clear about, they're asked, are you prepared to be with someone who has a child? And they say yes. I think the biggest disappointment for me this year was Sean and Joe.
Right.
Because Sean and Joe were both very clear in interviews with all of us and testing that they did not go by looks. They went by personality.
Everyone says that, though, eh?
They do, and clearly.
Yeah.
Sean, that was too much for him.
Hey, what would be your advice to those of us who would never have the gall to sign up to Married at First Sight, and those people who are listening who looking for love. What would be your advice, or your observation in terms of perhaps the number one point of attraction? What do you think is perhaps the most important thing? Is it physical attraction? Is it pheromones? What do you put it down to?
Well, it's the three main ones. I mean, it's quite complex and complicated. We all agree. But the three main ones are attractiveness. But attractiveness is not just physically beautiful, whether you're a woman or a man. It's actually your vitality. So it's your energy that makes you attractive to the other person.
Right.
There may be a little bit of mum and dad's looks, because in those early years, the first faces we see are mum and dad and as a baby. And so we become familiar with that bone structure.
Yeah.
So we tend to go for similar bone structures. So attractiveness, vitality, caring. We know that they did research over 5,000 couples, and these were the three around the world. So it's cross-cultural.
Yeah.
And these are the three things: attractiveness, vitality, caring, being a really caring, kind person, and intellectual compatibility.
Right. Okay. Those are valuable. I don't think anything maybe especially surprising in there, but basically what you're saying is you need someone who operates on the same frequency, more or less, through, you know, whether that's through the same intellectual frequency and same energy. All of those things need to work together.
Yes, and I think the energies around optimism and enjoyment of life, you know, that can be very attractive, as attractive to people as physical, you know, colour of hair or things like that.
Yeah.
And then there are a whole lot of things underneath that, including pheromones and all those kind of things.
Tricia, we could speak all day. Honestly, we could. You are a fascinating subject. Thank you so much for making time for us this morning. And like I say, I actually, you know what you need to do? You need to write another book. That's what you need to do.
I need the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, you probably don't have a whole lot of spare time at the moment. But no, we're really enjoying, I know so many of our listeners are really enjoying Married at First Sight, but it is a real pleasure to speak with you this morning. Thank you so much for your time.